It surprises probably no one for us to say that the first 3 years of life are critical for the development of any human being. A lot happens in brain and body in those first 3 years, and the presence of attentive parents, especially the mother, is essential. Erica Commissar explores just how essential in her new book, Being There, why prioritizing motherhood in the first 3 years matters. Erica Commissar is a social worker, psychoanalyst, and parent guidance expert in New York, where she's practiced for 25 years now. Her work as a consultant brings workshops to places where parents and or kids gather. Think schools and corporations and pretty much all the above. Erica's own three kids are in their teens now. Erica Commissar, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
So did you delay this book actually to spend more time with your own kids?
I did. I started to really think about writing this book about 13 years ago. And my own children were very young at the time. I have a 17-year-old, a 15-year-old, and almost a 13-year-old. So, you know, 13 years ago, just after I'd had my baby, I said, right, the book is about waiting. It's being able to put off some of your ambition to a time when your children need you a little bit less. So I waited. And then about 3 years ago, I picked it up in earnest and took all the research that I'd been looking at for the past 13 years and put it together into this book.
All right, so most mothers are not going to be writing a book or something quite that time intensive, but a lot of them do have the basic issue of having to go back to work, and can they still be there for their kids?
Yeah, so what I was finding is that as a society, we had devalued mothering, and as a result, we were failing our children. And what I was seeing in my parent guidance practice was this epidemic level of emotionally troubled children with serious symptoms being diagnosed at an earlier and earlier age and being medicated, really, much younger for things like early aggression and behavioral problems and ADHD and social disorders. And it was really troubling in my practice. And I've been really seeing it over the last, I'd say, 20 years. And, you know, I started connecting it in my practice to the absence of mothers on a daily basis in children's lives. And then the research that I looked into, the neuroscience and attachment and epigenetics research, really backed me up.
So what you were seeing in the research was backing up the kinds of things you're hearing from people in your practice?
Yeah, and the way I work with patients in my practice is to really help mothers to prioritize their children and also to deal with their postpartum depression, which may be interfering with that attachment and, you know, the ability to prioritize their children. And, yeah, I was seeing as I worked with these women to really prioritize, the symptoms of the children got better, but the mothers were happier as well.
You know, I never thought of therapy and psychoanalysis this way, but you say you're in the business of making people feel uncomfortable.
Yes. Well, that's it. I mean, I'm not a counselor. I'm a psychoanalyst. And so, yeah, we definitely get people to look at themselves. So things like when mothers say to me, well, your book makes me feel guilty, I say, well, guilt is not a bad feeling. You know, we say in my field that guilt is a signal feeling. It's like a red flag. It says, ooh, I have conflict. I need to look at this conflict. I need to be more self-reflective about this conflict. Maybe if I look at it, I might make a slightly different decision or make a slightly different choice. So, you know, for me, guilt means that a mother's conscience is working. So when a mother is separated from a baby in the first 3 years, it causes stress in both the mother and the baby. And we can see that through these salivary tests, these cortisol tests, that mothers and babies both get very stressed out when they're separated early. And that is the basis of guilt, right? So when we feel stressed about leaving our baby, you know, guilt is a signal. It says, you know, wait, look at me. Something's wrong here. So, yeah, I don't see guilt as a bad thing.
Cortisol is well known to us here in the exchange. That is the stress hormone, isn't it?
It is the stress hormone. And, you know, in small quantities, meaning babies can deal with little bits of separation throughout the day. The younger the baby, the less they can deal with the amount of separation. So as the baby gets older, they can start to deal with incrementally more separation and more stress. But when we impose too much frustration and too much stress on babies too early, it has really, we're seeing now, has very negative impacts on babies.
I was noticing that the average time that women seem to take off for the birth of a child in America is about 10 weeks.
That's an interesting figure because the figure that I have is 27% of women in America go back to work after 2 weeks.
27% after 2 weeks?
2 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the average now. So, you know, 10 weeks implies that you have some kind of maternity leave policy. You know, we're the only civilized country in the world that doesn't recognize the value of mothers to babies. You know, in every other civilized country, there's some kind of maternity leave that is a paid maternity leave, and as you know, we have nothing. So this is what I mean by sort of societal devaluation. But I was seeing a phenomenon in my practice, to be frank, that was not just about mothers who had to return to work, because really it isn't a book about working versus not working. It's a book about prioritizing whether you work or don't work. But I was seeing a phenomenon of more and more mothers returning to work because they wanted to, for lifestyle reasons or because they were bored being with their babies or uncomfortable being with their babies. So for me, this is undiagnosed postpartum depression, and rather than giving up on these mothers and saying, go back to work, leave your babies early because you're uncomfortable, I work with these mothers. Basically, I don't give up on any mother.
All right, so that's a pretty tough thing to take in for a mother, though. It's like when they're thinking that no, I really need to get back to work, I need to do this, and you're saying it's because they're feeling postpartum depression?
So, yes, it is a mild form of postpartum depression, meaning, you know, should I say this, it's not so abnormal to be bored with someone else's baby, but when you feel bored or uncomfortable caring for your own baby, it is a form of postpartum depression. You know, there is also this phenomenon in society now where we have babies. Women have a great desire to have babies for biological reasons, for societal reasons, you know, peer pressure. But there's a real difference in terms of having a baby versus caring for a baby. And so it's really important for children's mental health that we also want to care for them in those first 3 years.
Which is the major theme of Erica Commissar's book, Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. We'll come back and talk more with Erica and take phone calls and emails from you. This is the Jefferson Exchange. We'll be back in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you so much for listening. We're talking about how important the first 3 years of a child's life are and why it is so important for a mother to be around a lot in that first 3 years. Erica Commissar is a social worker, psychoanalyst, and parent guidance expert in New York. Her book is called Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. We mentioned the fact that you say you're in the business of making people feel uncomfortable, and this book will do that at times as well, particularly when you talk about how we're failing our kids in society. But I want to zero in on roles in child's development here, though. It is maternal absence more than anything else you think that is to blame for that?
So, yeah, that's what I'm finding in my practice. Basically, human beings are what we call alloparental, meaning they can have multiple attachment figures, but still primarily one, what we call primary attachment figure, who really provides the basis for their emotional security. So I think if you asked any mother, whether she's working or not, whether she has a unique and special place in her children's life in terms of the emotional security, every mother, even a mother who works, you know, vigorously, would tell you she's special to her baby. And that is the truth, that mothers have a unique biological role that they play for children. And, you know, studies show that fathers are so important. I mean, fathers are critical for children's development as well, but they're not interchangeable with mothers for a variety of reasons.
All right, I'm going to ask about fathers, but I'll let Connie and Eugene do that for me. Welcome to the Jefferson
sure.
Exchange.
Yes, good morning. You brought up my topic, which is role increasingly in at least my area here in Eugene. I had three men who were the stay-at-home dads for young children, and I thought they were terrific fathers. The wives had good-paying jobs, and that's just one aspect. We have gay parents as well, and we have, I think, the reality that a woman may not be the best caregiver. Just because she's female does not mean, I don't think, and I'm not a psychoanalyst, that she is inherently the best caregiver. She may be the biological mother, but there may be another partner who is a better caregiver. And so I just wonder about sort of dumping all this on a woman if there is a partner who is a better caregiver. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Connie. Appreciate it.
It's a very good question. So, you know, just to sort of finish my thought, which is that women and men both produce something called oxytocin when they nurture. It's a chemical in the brain we sometimes call the love hormone or the bonding hormone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and but it has a different impact on men and women. It actually makes women more, meaning when women stay with their children and nurture their children primarily, it produces a lot of what we call sensitive empathic nurturing, meaning mothers will lean into pain more, and in fathers, it makes them more playfully stimulating. It makes them throw the baby up in the air higher, or tickle the baby more intensely. So it does have a different impact on mothers and fathers. And to answer your question about what happens when mothers are not nurturing, so this is a problem for me because what I'm seeing is generationally, we're not passing down nurturing biologically to mothers because of something called epigenetics, which is the environment influences our biology. And basically, nurturing is passed down to the next generation. So when you have a very sensitive, empathic nurturer who's a mother, she then passes that down to the next generation. It's shown in animal research and human research. If our mothers were not nurturing and were absent or distracted or depressed, that doesn't get passed down to the next generation. So there are a lot of women out there right now with children who, and I agree with you, who are not really healthy nurturers. And the question of fathers is an interesting question. We can teach this stuff. We can teach fathers how to be more sensitive and empathic nurturers. We can teach mothers how to be more sensitive and empathic nurturers. You know, to give you a long answer, the best example I can use for you is if you go to the park and you see when a baby falls down, generally a healthy mother who responds to her baby will lean into the baby's pain and say, "Oh, how are you, sweetheart," and hug the baby and basically provide this kind of empathy. Fathers will say, "Oh, you're okay, come on, you'll be fine, let's go play again," which is encouraging resilience, which is what they've been doing for thousands of years biologically. So if fathers are going to stay home with their children, then we need to teach them to do more of what mothers do in those first 3 years.
I want to come back to oxytocin for just a second because you do have an episode in the book where Dr. Ruth Feldman gave an oxytocin nasal spray to fathers. What did that end up doing?
So it tends to make fathers more playfully stimulating. It does make them somewhat more sensitive, but really what it makes them do is it makes them more excited, playful fathers. And again, to say that that's a critical role in children's development because that helps children to separate from their mothers. So fathers have always played a critical role in helping children to separate, right? To say to the baby, come over here, come play with me, the water's fine. That's been a father's role. So, yes, the intranasal oxytocin did increase some sensitivity, but it made them more playfully stimulating.
Erica Commissar is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, social worker, psychoanalyst, and parent guidance expert. Her book is Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. There's a couple of myths you take apart early in the book, number one being that there can be a perfect mother. You must get blue in the face saying this to people.
There's no perfect mother. There's no perfect child. There's no perfect human being. We're not trying to be perfect, and yet we're always trying to be better. You know, a book like mine, as you said, makes women feel guilty. And for me, when somebody feels guilty, it means that their conscience is working and that they are looking at themselves, hopefully in order to do the best job that they can do. And I've never met a mother who doesn't want to be the best mother she can be.
Number two, the number two myth you explode here is I can be a good mother only if I neglect my own needs. Not true, then.
No. You know, what I say to mothers is we lend our narcissism to children, but we get it back eventually, meaning we have healthy narcissism. You know, everybody thinks of the word narcissism as a bad word, but in fact, we also have something called healthy narcissism, which means we like ourselves. So you could also say self-esteem. We like ourselves. We have our own interests. We are an individual. And, you know, for a short time, and, you know, I say to mothers, we're all going to live so long. We're all going to live till 100 is what they tell us, or even longer. And you have such a short window to make this critical influence on your child's emotional well-being and mental health. You have a very long time to do everything else.
Is the three-year window we're talking about here sort of weighted to one end, like, I don't know, the earthquake scale? I mean, it's more important in the early days than it is at the end of the 3 years?
You know, it's really critical throughout. You know, what I say is that right now the policies of many private companies, because we do have some private companies giving some maternity leave policies, particularly where your radio is broadcast, California, Oregon. There are some progressive companies that are giving some kind of maternity leave. But, you know, usually it's 3 months. At most, it's, you know, maybe 4 months. In rare case, 6 months. But you'd say at 3 months, a baby is just waking up from birth. You know, birth takes a toll on a baby. It's traumatic. There are actually even some theories that say that babies are born 9 months too early, meaning they have no central nervous system to deal with the overwhelming stimulus of life. And their mothers are literally their central nervous system, or what we call their emotional skin, in those first 9 months. And then going forward, mothers, again, provide this critical function of emotional regulation from moment to moment, every day, all day long.
But then we get the myth number three that you take apart. Stay-at-home moms are better than working moms for kids' mental and emotional health. So you can work and be there for the child, but you're going to have to dedicate some real attention to this.
The word is prioritizing, and, you know, again, we chose that word very carefully because, I mean, in an ideal world, what I would hope is that women would take off as long as they possibly can and then push it even more. Obviously, that we had a maternity leave policy in this country that was a real maternity leave policy, but that women take off until that day as long as they possibly can and then do the kind of work where they can still prioritize their children for the most part. And that may mean part-time work. And there's lots of good advice for working mothers in the book. So the idea is work less, be with your children more in those early years because you only have that small window to make that critical, to have that critical influence.
There's a later myth that part-time work is better arranged in fewer days and longer hours. You disagree?
So, yeah, think about the younger the baby, the shorter the window that they can be without you. The older the child, the longer the window that they can be without you. So it's incremental as they develop. So we don't want to leave them for 12-hour days, 3 days a week, and then be there all of a sudden for those other days. That may be good for us, but it's not good for them. Better that you leave them for short windows of time every day and come back and then not go out again. You know, I say to mothers who work, once out, once in, that every time you leave a baby, unless there's an emergency, every time you leave a baby, it's a trauma for that baby, that separation, particularly very young babies. So once out, once in. So if you work 4 hours a day or 5 hours a day, instead of working 3, 12, or 13-hour days, that's better for the baby.
So once you're reunited, stay reunited.
Yes.
Erica Commissar is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, social worker, psychoanalyst, parent guidance expert. Her book is Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. You just heard her say why they chose the word prioritizing so carefully. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange. You might have a few thoughts about motherhood and its importance and maybe how you conducted it or how it was conducted upon you. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's get into some real scientific mom keys here. Why the mother is more important than the father or anybody else. I mean, the child's brain responds differently to the sound of a mother's voice?
Yes. There's lots of research to show that babies identify their mothers as being unique from the very beginning. Not only voice, but pictures shown to the baby of their mother versus other women, their brains respond differently, as does their sensory sort of attention to smell. So when they're given breast pads soaked with mother's milk versus another woman's milk, they turn right to the mother's milk. So, you know, we're animals. I don't know how else to say it. We are animals. And so things like smell and you know, our senses are really what make us attached to our mothers. You know, even when children are adopted, because I know that's going to be a question from someone, so I might as well answer it before I get it. Even when we're adopted, whoever becomes our primary caregiver, who is primarily responsible to us, for us, we attach to in this primary way, through sense, through the way they look, through the way they smell, And yes, babies identify their mothers as being unique.
Okay, so that's the basic way the brain works. While we're on brains, what is your view on encouraging cognitive development early?
So I say in the book that, and you know, I'm a consultant to many nursery schools in New York, so it's not that I have anything against learning, but when we push cognitive development too early and before we've really allowed for social-emotional development, it's like putting your shoes on before your socks. We really need to foster social-emotional right-brain development before we foster cognitive development. And the reason being, what lives in the right brain is the ability to tolerate frustration. So learning comes with frustration. If we learn before we have the emotional ability to regulate our emotions and tolerate frustration, then it's going to cause increased stress and increased frustration for children. And that's what I'm seeing.
Let's take another call. I'll go to Jay in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Erica Commissar, the author of Being There.
Yeah, hi, thank you. My sister had twins where she had to leave her work. And when you were talking about the guilt that she felt at that time, I never recognized it as guilt, but rather than dealing with the guilt, she dealt with it by being angry to anybody that pointed out that financially the care that she was paying for was actually eating up all of the money that she was making, and there was no way to rationalize that. She ran away from the guilt by working. But my question was, now it's been 8 years later, 9 years later, and I wonder what are the manifestations of her being away or prioritizing, as you put it, the work over the child rearing. Thank you.
So I might address the first part of it first, which is the anger that she expressed to you was defensiveness. And defensiveness is, think of fight or flight. Think of, in the face of danger, as human beings, we've always become aggressive. And I think your sister, I think it was your sister, not your sister-in-law, was probably quite frightened of the things you were saying. They scared her. And so in response to the fear, she became aggressive. And that's what I'm seeing in children, too, is that what is being perceived by the schools and by parents as aggression is, in fact, aggression as a response to fear and feeling vulnerable. Okay, so that would be the first piece of it. The second is, you know, there isn't going to be a one-to-one correlation between what your sister did or didn't do and what's going to happen to her children. And yet what we're seeing is an increase in things like aggression, behavioral problems, ADHD, social disorders, and that goes straight through adolescence. So, you know, the book that I'm working on now is actually the wormhole between toddlerhood and adolescence, that actually we get another chance, if you want to say, we have another chance to make things right in adolescence because it's another period of brain growth and brain pruning. And as a result, we also see a lot of the disorders that may not have showed up earlier with children who've been not attended to enough by their mothers. We see those disorders come up in adolescence. And adolescence now is between 9 and 29. And what we're seeing is a 119% increase in eating disorders in the last decade in teenagers, teenagers and young adults. We see an increase in addiction of all kinds, an increase in depression and anxiety. So there's a 400% increase in children between the ages of 12 and 19 now since the 80s on antidepressants and anti-anxiety meds. So can I say that your sister's kids are going to have issues? I can't, because there are some kids that seem to make it through fine. We don't know why. We say in a shipwreck, there's always survivors. But many of these children are not okay.
Let's come back to something you mentioned a little earlier, which is the women who talk about how they find their kids a bit boring. Where do you think that comes from, and how do you counsel patients who say, look, I'm a little bored of my newborn. There's not much going on there.
So boredom is a form of postpartum depression. So we all have boring moments. I mean, Jeff, in your radio job, I'm sure you have boring moments. We all have boring moments in our jobs. But to be bored versus having boring moments, when we have a boring moment, the boring moment passes and we can go on. But when we feel an overriding feeling of being bored, it's usually a sign of depression. Bored, when a child says, I feel bored, it means they feel understimulated. So that means that that mother is looking to that baby to stimulate her rather than the mother stimulating the baby. And usually for me, it's a sign that that mother is suffering a lot. That mother was an understimulated baby. That mother's mother was not interested in mothering, or was depressed, or was distracted, or couldn't be there physically and emotionally for some reason. And so then that gets passed down to the next generation. And this is really concerning to me, and this is what I treat in my practice.
So in particular, when a mother has the thought that apparently they've related to you a few times, this is not the child I thought I'd get. I thought that they'd be this wonderful little love affair, and for 3 years I'd want to be around this kid, and he drives me crazy. How do you counsel them there?
So really interesting that many women have babies today, young women, without really knowing what it's like. I don't know that we've done any great favors by encouraging the fantasy that having a baby is all roses and sweetness, you know, cuddles and bunny rabbits. It is affection and love, but it's a lot of hard work and a great deal of sacrifice and no sleep for 5 years.
5 years. Okay, we're clear on that now. The book is called Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. Erica Commissar is the author and our guest. We'll return to the Jefferson Exchange and take a few more phone calls and emails from you in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. If we were to say out loud, hey, the first 3 years of childhood is really important for the mother to be there, they'd probably produce a collective eye roll around the region and anybody who's listening. But the fact is that it is accentuated in Erica Commissar's book, Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. And she gets into very specific examples and a lot of scientific research as well. Erica Commissar, social worker, psychoanalyst, and parent guidance expert in New York. You can join our discussion on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Next phone call goes to Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Erica Commissar.
Hi, Jeffrey, and hi, Erica. Thanks so much
hi.
For taking my call. I really love your book. I spent the morning scrolling through various parts of it on Amazon, seeing and noticing that, you know, I totally agree with everything you're saying. And I can't wait for your next book. But I wanted to point out that, well, a couple comments and then a question. I grew up in the kind of family that did not get the kind of support. And so that was really needed for thriving in the world. And have spent most of my life in one capacity or another in helping professions. And I later in life, I discovered the ACEs study.
Mm-hmm. Adverse childhood experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the correlation between early childhood or adverse childhood experiences and later physical and mental health issues. And when I reflect back on my various careers, I see that everybody that I was working with was damaged in some way from early childhood, from lack of kind of sensitive mothering that you have described. And surviving is not the same as thriving.
No.
So people I worked with all survived. They all survived, but many of them their lives were a mess. And I've had my own challenges that showed up in my 50s and I'm still struggling with. And I was wondering, if you're aware of the work of Canadian psychologist, developmentalist Gordon Neufeld, mm-hmm. who wrote a book called Hold On to Your Kids, Why Parents Need to Matter More Than Peers. And he puts that window of time from 0 to 5. And so I was wondering what are your thoughts about that compared to like 0 to 3?
Okay, 0 to 3 or 0 to 5. Thank you, Sandy. Appreciate that.
Thank you for the question. So, you know, the truth is that our children need us throughout. If I wrote that book, do you think anybody would buy it? I think that there are certain critical windows of development that we can now see actually through technology, things like fMRIs, and you know, we can actually see the brain in a way that we couldn't before. And we know that by 3 years old, the brain is 85% developed, the social-emotional part of the brain.
85%, really?
Mm-hmm. Wow. So it is a really important period of development. That doesn't mean that 3 to 5 isn't. And what I'm seeing, and I think it's a really good question that he asked, because what I'm seeing is a lot of regression. Regression is when children that are 3 are really acting developmentally much younger. And so at 5, they're still behaving like 3-year-olds because they're not developing in the same way. And many of them, as this man was saying, and the ACEs was an amazing study. It was the first really great grand study on how adversity in early childhood impacts people in adulthood. And that was a really important connection, and that's in my book as well, on the ACEs, because, you know, we've always known that early adversity, early neglect, early abuse impacts adolescents and adults, but, you know, we always need research and statistics to prove what we are seeing in our practices.
We talked a lot of theory and not a lot of practice, and there are some good case studies in here. I'm struck in particular by the story of the mom who got home at 6:30 and put her bed to child at 7:30.
Mm-hmm.
Not a good way to do things, you point out.
That's a very common thing, though, for working mothers, is they come home and they literally see their children for an hour. And the Pew Research Trust did a study of working mothers and found that they spend on average between 60 and 90 minutes a day with their children under the age of 3. So this is a problem, because if what I'm saying is that we help to regulate our baby's emotions throughout the day from moment to moment, if we're only spending an hour a day with our child, it's not as if children are like vases where you put them on the counter and they stay exactly where you left them until you get back and then you can restart. Things are happening for them all day long on their time, and they're needing you. And when you're not there enough, the results are what I'm seeing.
Is there a rough benchmark for how much time you think that mothers should be spending with kids at this age?
So what I say in the book is more is more. The more emotionally and physically available mothers can be in those first 3 years, the better off those children will be. And there are some studies that were done in the 80s to say that, and again, these aren't my studies. There was a study done in the 80s to show that children who were in child care for more than 20 hours a week under the age of 1 experienced aggressive behavior later on. And again, these aren't my studies, but that sounds about right to me, that when you take very small children and you put them in childcare for too many hours a week, you're going to start to see signs and symptoms, and that is what I'm seeing in my practice.
So more is more. More time is good time. Now, how to maximize the time when you don't have as much as you might like? I mean, when a woman does have to work, obviously you try to stretch it beyond an hour a day, but in the time together, how to limit distractions and how to focus as much as possible on the child. What are some of the things you recommend?
So I'm just going to say that the more time you have, the better. So I pinch pennies with mothers, and I'll say, can you leave a little later? Can you get back a little earlier? Can you keep your child up as late as possible to be with you so they're getting 2 or 3 hours a night of really comfort and reassurance, and where from moment to moment you're regulating them? But some of the other things that mothers who work can do is put your distractions away. When you come home, and this is for working or non-working mothers, there's plenty of mothers who are around all the time physically and aren't there emotionally. Put your distractions in a basket at the door. Put the phones, the tablets, the computers. Do not pick them up again until your children are asleep. Or some of the things that I say to working mothers are, be there at transition times. Going to sleep is a really critical transition time for children. Waking up is a really critical time. Going to school, coming back from school. So the first thing I'll say to a mother who's starting to show signs of stress in her child is I'll say, you know, I know you work. I know it's hard. Can you leave earlier so you can pick your child up from school and work from home the last 2 hours of the day? You know, things where you're there at those transition points, which are the most vulnerable points for children.
Question here from Karen in Mount Shasta. She dropped it off, didn't stay on the line. Wants to know if there's a correlation between autism and early development.
So the answer is that autism is a biological disorder. We know that now. there is research going on. Again, this is not my research, but this is what the research says, that stress in utero is what's possibly contributing to autism in boys. There's also research by my mentors, Alan Shore, who's just come out with a wonderful article that was just in the New York Times about, you know, how boys' brains are much more sensitive to stress in the early years than even girls' brains. And there's a lot of really good research, including his out there, to suggest that boys are much more sensitive to the separation from their mothers and to stress in the early days, including in utero, and that's contributing to autism. But what we are seeing as clinicians is an increase in autistic-like symptoms. So there's a difference between true autism and autistic-like symptoms. So I am seeing children with these social disorders where they really can't interact socially normally, but they may not have autism. But that is related to right brain development.
So they don't have the biological underpinnings, but they're displaying some of the behaviors.
That's right.
Okay, so let's talk about resilience in a broader sense, though, because that comes up a lot in the book, and it seems to like you're batting away a lot of suggestions from people that, come on, the kid can take a tumble now and then, sort of like the fatherly approach to things. It's like, come on, get up, you're fine. But you're saying kids are not that emotionally resilient, at least not until about age three.
That's right. They're not born resilient. We make them resilient by actually relieving their stress and providing comfort when they're in distress from moment to moment. That's how we provide the foundation. So eventually they can deal with more frustration and they can deal with more adversity. But they're not born that way. And what will happen if you make a child become too independent too quickly and too resilient too quickly, if you force it on them, many children will adapt to this but will not actually have formed the necessary connections internally. They form what we call a defensive kind of independence, which is like a hard candy coating with soft inside. So that means that the first sign of adversity, real adversity, the shell cracks and what's revealed is the vulnerability underneath. So you really want to build a child from the inside out, and to do that you really have to be there.
Just in terms of things like physical proximity, though, and here we get into the discussion of attachment parenting, and I think a lot of people remember that magazine cover of a few years ago with a woman breastfeeding the child who was clearly more than old enough to stand up.
Mm-hmm.
So a bit of a controversy there. So how much physical proximity, how long should breastfeeding go on, how much does all this get rolled into what you're talking about here?
So, you know, I wouldn't exactly call myself an attachment parenting clinician. I would say I value attachment to be of equal importance, healthy attachment to be of equal importance to healthy separation. So it's as greatly important to help your child to separate in a healthy way as it is to make them attach and bond in a healthy way. So some of the attachment parenting literature encourages attachment without really talking a lot about the separation. So with my practice and with my patients, I talk to them equally about healthy separation and giving your child space almost from the beginning, because children are individuals from the very beginning. And so we need to leave some space between us and them.
Okay, the idea of regulating your child's emotions I found fascinating. The idea that the mother is really the emotional lid for a child for mm-hmm. the first few years.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is, though, the problem that some mothers expressed to you that they thought they knew what the kid's emotions were and they were wrong. I mean, which I guess gets back to the much larger sense of, like, you know, you're going to make mistakes. Get used to it.
I think that gets back to the idea of being imperfect. So all we can do is try. And what I encourage mothers to do is to reflect their baby's emotions. And to reflect means we really have to be good at observing, not only observing our baby's emotions, but ourselves. So if we look at our baby's face and their body, so babies first express their emotions through their bodies and their facial expressions. And if you look at a baby's face and their body and how they're wriggling, you can get a sense of what they're feeling. And then if you reflect that, mirror that with your own face. So when the baby is sad, you make what we call the woe face, which is a sad face in response to show that you understand how the baby is feeling. You really can't go wrong if you look at your baby. I find that mothers are not really looking at their babies.
They're not. What are they looking at?
Well, they're preoccupied with, as you said earlier, with guilt feelings. So they'll look at the baby and they'll try to cheer the baby up because they're uncomfortable with the baby being uncomfortable. And so, you know, this is a problem because babies, for them to feel that we recognize them and to really develop the social right emotional brain, they need to feel that we understand their feelings from moment to moment. Some psychoanalytic theorists believe that it's in a mother reflecting her baby's emotions that a baby actually for the first time experiences himself.
So you've already mentioned that that we, unlike a lot of civilized countries, don't provide a lot of leave. I imagine that is probably number one on your priority list for what we as a society can do to make more of this important time available between mother and child.
Indeed. I mean, I believe that with all my heart. You know, I think that as private companies continue to try to provide maternity leave, and I admire them for it, it's just not enough because it doesn't serve all women and it doesn't serve the underprivileged population of women, and it really isn't enough maternity leave. I mean, so there's a real misunderstanding, I think, about how much is enough.
Have you talked to anybody in a political position to do something about this, somebody who could pass laws, talk to the New York State Legislature or Congress or anybody?
So I interviewed Nita Lowy, who's working on a Social Security Credit Act, and I'm trying to reach people in the current administration as we speak and trying to get an op-ed piece in one of the major papers, a letter to Ivanka, if you will, to really describe why 3 months is just not enough.
All right. 3 years, a very important period. That is the major theme of Erica Commissar's book, Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. Erica, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take care.